Today I have in the studio with me Pamela White, who served as the United States Ambassador to Haiti from August 2012 until September 2015. Prior to that, she was the U.S. Ambassador to Gambia. She also was the head of multi-million dollar aid programs in Mali, Tanzania, and Liberia. Originally from Auburn, she now lives in Oars Island with her husband, Steve. And I hear that you also have two lovely grown sons who live in the Washington, D.C. area. And Steve also has two children. So you guys have been all over the place, and you've been raising children in the midst of it all.
That's right. We have.
So congratulations, and thanks for coming back to Maine and also for coming in and talking to me.
It's a pleasure. Great.
I'm interested in hearing more about why a woman from Auburn, born in Lewiston, ended up doing things all over the world. Some people just kind of hang in there and never really leave their place of origin, but that wasn't your path.
Nope. I made up my mind basically what I was going to do with my life when I was 18. I was a senior at Edward Little High School, and my cousin Jim had come home from the Vietnam War almost dead. And he had all kinds of things coming out of him, and he was my favorite cousin. And I was just devastated. And as, you know, luck would have it, circumstances would have it, that very same week, a team, which I think the first and the last team ever, from Peace Corps, Washington, D.C., came to my high school. And they had these slides about how you could help people in Africa, and how you could make a difference in the world. And back then, there were kind of two ways of getting out in the world. One was the military, and one was this thing, Peace Corps, which was pretty new back then. I mean, that was 1967. And so I went home and I said to my dad, who's a Marine, Dad, I'm going to join the Peace Corps. And he said, absolutely not. And I said, I'm going to go to Africa. And he said, absolutely not. But I said, I am going to do it. And 4.5 years later, I was in Africa. I never changed my mind. I knew that was what I wanted to do.
And why? What was that? What was the draw for you?
It just was a different way for engaging in the world, and I kind of knew I wanted to engage in the world. I mean, I saw these pictures up on this giant screen in my gym, and I've gone back to that same gym and talked to students about trying to engage in the world also, and it was so spooky to be in this place where I had made a life decision, and fun, and kind of... It was interesting because I started my career as a Peace Corps volunteer and I ended my career as a U.S. ambassador, which is very unusual to sort of go from one end to the other. And I had made my mind up when I was very young.
I believe that your father was in the audience watching you give your speech at the University of Maine 2016 commencement.
He certainly was. He was in the audience. Steve was in the audience. One of my sons from Washington, D.C. was in the audience. My best friend, Cindy Watson, was in the audience. And my mother, Sandy Peters, was in the audience. So she had my mother's sorority sister, Alpha Phi, from University of Maine. So very close, long-time friends were there. And it was so much fun to have them there because they had not been with me my whole career, but they had followed my whole career. And so to turn around and be able to wave to my 95-year-old dad was really special. And he told me later that he didn't really know that he was crying, but there were tears coming down his cheeks unexplainably through the whole thing because it was a matter of just pride and interest and seeing his daughter up there and giving a speech that got a standing ovation, which was very unusual. They told me it's the first time in 25 years that they had seen a standing ovation. So to have him there was very special.
So why did he doubt that you would make it in the Peace Corps? Why would he say to you, don't do it?
Oh my God, back then going to Africa was like going to Mars or something. Anything anybody knew about Africa was what they read in the National Geographic, which was not exactly comforting. Kind of wild looking people that were barely dressed and, you know, animals roaming around. And so Africa was not the Africa that you know, I've grown to know and love with some, you know, kind of freaky, exotic, strange, scary place. And so when I went home and said, I want to go to the Africa, like, absolutely not. You go to the University of Maine, you have babies, and, you know, that's what women do around here. And like I said, you know, it was just so, I mean, no one that I knew in University of Maine had ever even heard, really, of Peace Corps, and certainly no one was joining Peace Corps. I mean, they called me the ape lady, and you had strange sounds all the time. I mean, I was just convinced I was gonna do it, and I ended up in this village. You know, it was so idealistic. I mean, I was going to save the world. And then it came down, well, maybe I could just save Africa. And then, well, maybe I could just save the region. And then, well, maybe just Cameroon, which is the country I went to. And then, well, maybe I could just save my village. But interestingly enough, really, my village, you know, saved me in many ways, because they taught me lifelong lessons, as I mentioned in my speech at the University of Maine. And they taught me this lesson that poverty is not about money. Poverty is much more something of the soul, or lack of friends and lack of family and lack of culture and lack of history. I mean, when you're rich in all those things, then you are in fact rich. And so you don't have to worry about the fact that that person sitting across from you is not a multimillionaire, is not making tons of money. That person, especially the elders in my village, they were so rich in so many important ways. And it's a lesson I've carried with me forever. And it was a village, no running water, no electricity, you know, very few vegetables, no red meat, no white people, no one speaking English. And I looked around when I first got there, scared to death, like, wow, what am I going to do here? I mean, there were no white people. And I grew up in Maine. There were no black people in Maine. And yet these people took me in and loved me and taught me, as I said, life lessons. So it just changed my life.
It's interesting to me that you were a young white woman from Maine, chose to go to Africa, was chosen to become the ambassador to Gambia. You were also the mission director of USAID in Liberia, and you were also the mission director of USAID in Tanzania. So, but this must have taken some, like, I can't use an impolite term, but, you know, it must have taken some guts, to be willing to go into those situations.
Yeah, it did, actually. At the time of it, I didn't think about it so much. I just did it. But Liberia, tough place, just coming out of a violent 14-year civil war where people did horrible things to each other. And it was a country led by Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who was a Nobel Peace Prize winner, a fabulous woman. But as fabulous as she was, it was a country still in turmoil, very difficult to make progress in a country where the entire, or at least 70% of the population, hadn't recovered from the war. They had blanks on their faces. And so in many ways, Liberia was my toughest country and a real challenge. It was one of my favorite stories about Liberia was that I had gone from Liberia much to the disappointment of President Sirleaf, and to be ambassador in the Gambia. And then when I was in the Gambia, I got a phone call from Secretary Clinton asking me to be ambassador to Haiti. And just after that, Secretary Clinton was in Liberia with President Sirleaf again, and President Sirleaf said, bring Pam back here. Please bring her back here as ambassador. So they call me in the Gambia, and they said, okay, you know, you've got a choice. You can go to Haiti, or you can come back to Liberia, because President Sirleaf so wants you to come back. And I so loved her, and I really thought about it. But I said, no, I'm so sorry. And I've seen her since, and she said, you turned me down. I decided to go to Haiti for a couple of reasons, but the major reason was that I had been there before. I'd started my Foreign Service career in many ways in Haiti. I joined the Foreign Service in Haiti in the 80s. And so to have that as my first Foreign Service post and have, at last, as a junior nothing officer in the 80s, an ambassador, and I used to take my kids to the residence, the ambassador's residence, in the 80s when they were babies, you know, little tiny things. and say, you know, you make you, you know, keep your little jackets on, and you make sure that you don't go anywhere, any room you're not supposed to go in, and you make sure this, and you make sure that you're well behaved, you know, and then to have bring them back for cocktails on the terrace 30 years later was a great experience.
Is it unusual to be raising children as you're working with the Foreign Service or
no.
being an ambassador?
No, it's, I mean, we, you know, my husband Steve was raised as a Foreign Service brat, as we sometimes call them, child, lived all over Africa when he was growing up also. So, you know, the Foreign Service, that's very, very common. But my children, by the time I had gotten into roles of very difficult roles that were extraordinarily time-consuming, were already in college. And I don't think you could be really an effective either mission director or certainly ambassador, because as ambassador I was not in the Gambia, which was a much less taxing job, but in Haiti I was working 16 17 18 hours a day for sure, 7 days a week. It was never off. I had 1400 people in the embassy. I had well over $1 billion I was responsible for. I had 13 agencies, the CIA, the FBI, the DEA, trying to bring them all together to form one team for the United States of America. So it was very taxing. I mean, one of your questions was, what would you have done differently 10 years ago? And I thought about it for a long time, like, because I'm so lucky for how my career has turned out. But I think I would have tried to balance work life maybe a little tiny bit better, which I was not good at all.
But how would you have done that? I mean, if you're in a situation where people are looking to you for coordination and leadership and sometimes answers, how do you easily
I don't think it's easy.
Balance?
I don't know. I couldn't do it. I didn't do it. But I mean, I've seen other people, you know, when it's 6 o'clock, they walk. They go home and they say, I put in my long day, and they get to the office. But I mean, there was one of my, if I might say, few criticism as ambassador. Someone came down and said, you know, Pam, please stop sending texts to your staff at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I said, well, I don't expect them to answer at 2 o'clock in the morning, but I'm up and I'm thinking and something's going through my mind. And they're like, well, they think that they should be sort of up 24/7 like you are. So just wait, you know, put it on, find if that's when you're thinking, but, you know, put it on save and send it when you get up and you're on your way in the morning. So I said, okay. So it was a lesson well learned, because not everyone is an insomniac like I am and working. And I didn't want them to. I mean, I said to them, I want you to have a family life. I want you to go home at 5:30, 6 o'clock at the night. And I'm, you know, I can't do that. And especially when you go home, either you're entertaining or you're being entertained. So it's not like you go home and, oh, the day's over, ever. And it's fun. You know, last night, President Martelly was a somewhat controversial president, but I believe with my heart and soul, a guy that truly had the best interest of Haiti and loved the Haitian people. But he called me last night and said, you know, I'm coming to Manhattan. I'm going to do a concert in Manhattan, and then maybe I'll come up to Maine and visit with you. And so you build these relationships, these lifelong relationships with people who are in the same circle as you are. They're trying so hard to make that country a better place. And, you know, President Sirleaf was the same, the President Kikwete of Tanzania. You know, over and over and over, you see people who are so dedicated to try to move the needle a little bit on the quality of lives of people who are less fortunate.
You referenced the questionnaire that we have all of our guests fill out when you said, if you could go back in time 10 years,
yeah,
what advice would you give yourself? And you said find a better work-life balance. It's interesting to me that on another question, we asked, what's the most rewarding part of your job? And you answered, making the world a better place for the disadvantaged, especially women and the poor, and influencing policy. And it really doesn't sound like you've changed your views on what you want to do in the world since you began this journey when you were in high school.
That's right. That's very true. I've kept my eye on that goal for decades. And I thought it was a worthy goal back then, and I still think it's a worthy goal. It was a whole lot harder to move the needle than I thought it was going to be. There is no doubt that I have done that. You know, there are absolute successes that I could look at and think, wow, you know, you really hit the mark then. And then there are also, years and years that I was working so hard to move countries forward, like Mali, which I adored and spent 4 years there, you know, right on the Sahara Desert. I certainly, at the time I was there, increased the number of young girls in school tremendously, by thousands and thousands. Got women involved in politics. I think we started with women's groups that maybe had 5,000, and when I left, there were maybe 50, 60,000. I mean, it was a real difference in the ability for women to participate in civil society, and it was wonderful. And then, you know, 2 years ago, the bad guys, the terrorists, come from the north of the Sahara Desert into Mali, with a very peaceful country of, you know, very moderate Muslims, don't like to fight, loved people, share everything. And these bad, bad guys come down through Mali and disrupt everything that we had done for years and years and years. And all these little schools that we had built, that all these girls that had never had access to education were in these schools and learning how to be historians and dietitians. And it's one of my favorite stories, because when I first asked the men of the desert to send their girls to school, they were like, why would we do that? Why would they need to go to school? And so I said, because these girls can write down your history. These girls can be your dietitians. They can write down the recipes that you passed down for years. These girls can be taught health methods that will help your women to be healthier across the board. And all of a sudden, it was not that they were just sending their girls for no reason. You can't just have no reason to send young children to school who have never been to school. So I had to change the curriculum. I had to get people trained in a whole new thing. We were practically, at the beginning, using little notebooks that people were writing stick figures in. And over the end, we got it all organized. But we changed the way people felt about education, for sure. I mean, these were Tuaregs. These are these blue men of the desert. When I first met them, they would come across the desert on their camels from 50, 60 miles away. They didn't want me to come to their homes at first, because they didn't want this nutty white woman to be where they were. And we would sit in a circle with their camels in the background and me talking about two things. I wanted them to use condoms, which didn't work very well, and sending their girls to school, which worked very well. So good success on one side and not a success at all on the other.
So when you're talking about the type of work that you are doing, it sounds like there's a significant amount of kind of sales and marketing.
Takes
place.
Absolutely. In fact, at the end of my career, the last 5 years or so, I became very, very interested in behavior change and what really makes people change behavior. Why would you, after centuries of not sending your girls to school, why would you do that? And I found out saying it's a good thing to do is not good enough. You need a better reason. And just like the condom thing did not work because, you know, we want you to space your children. That was not a good enough reason. So I learned right then and there, if you're going to do family planning, do not count on the men to do it. Count on the women to do it. So I completely changed my outlook. I give speeches all over the place. This is how you should approach family planning, at least in Africa. Let the women take responsibility for their own bodies and their own the number of children that they want, which tends to be very different in rural Africa than men, because having babies is sort of a status symbol, and the responsibility does not lie with the men. I mean, the women have full responsibility for babies until they're, teenagers. So that was an interesting thing. But yeah, how do you get people to use a bed net when bed nets aren't comfortable? And, you know, we've figured out a way of doing that. How do you get people to not be corrupt? And it's interesting, because it's often not what you think. It's not an easy answer to say, well, if we tell them it's not good for you, that's good enough. That in and of itself almost never is. So it's figuring out, how do you make that needle move? And it's so hard, and we spend millions on it, and I think we are getting better at it, but I'm not so sure that we're still there. And we, for many decades, we never measured it either. So did more people use bed nets? You can distribute bed nets easily. It's very easy to distribute a million bed nets. It's the, it's the use of them afterwards that makes a big difference. And on Zanzibar, which is an island right outside of Tanzania, we started with an incidence of about 40% of the people on that island every year had at least one incidence of malaria. And we had this program that we put in place, and after 2 years, it went down to 2%. And it's still less than 2%. And how did we do it? We had a fabulous marketing campaign. We had all the nets that we needed. We sprayed all the houses. We sprayed all the dead areas where the dead water was. We had people trained in doing rapid testing for malaria. We had people trained, the clinicians trained, so that as soon as a diagnosis was made, they could get treated. And it just, it was one of my favorite moments of my career. In fact, I was invited with the Minister of Health there to go to the White House as a reward for this amazing achievement. But part of it was just using political voices, the president of the country, Minister of Health, Minister of Education, me running around day after day, the ambassador, I wasn't the ambassador at the time, I was the head of AID, but the ambassador also, we were over there saying, if you're a good Zanzibarian, you're going to use a bed net. And we convinced them. And like I said, it's still, 20 years later, still going strong.
You strike me as a woman that doesn't like the word no, or maybe doesn't even hear the word no. I'm not really sure if you even acknowledge that no is a possible response to one of your suggestions.
Yeah. No, it's not. My husband's laughing over there. No, it's not a word that I use very often or is used with me in the room. It has been tried, but I can almost always find a solution to almost any problem. And if it fails, I'm not afraid of that either. I always tell young people, make a decision, evaluate it as soon as you can. Often, decisions in the developing world evaluations are done 2 years after a decision is made or a program is started. And I'm like, don't wait 2 years. Start evaluating within a month. Keep it coming. Because with technology today, there is no reason that you don't have a read on what is being done and how successful it is right away. And I have shut down programs. I mean, there was a program in Liberia on literacy. And so I went and visited some schools that were teaching, it was adult literacy, so it was at night. So I showed up at 5 o'clock, I'm looking at the whiteboards, and like, there's nothing on the whiteboard. And they're like, oh, well, we haven't started yet. Oh, we started, but we finished. I said, well, the lessons only started 10 minutes ago, 20 minutes. Oh, well, tonight we're gonna concentrate more on, drinking coffee or whatever. So I'm like, this does not look, it's working. And it was a $50 million program. And so I went to another school, and they were so proud because the enrollment numbers were supposed to be 5,000 and there were 15,000 because everyone was coming, eating the cookies and drinking the coffee and tea and, kibitzing. So I said, this doesn't look too good to me, so let's do a rapid assessment. And so I had a team come out from Washington, a rapid assessment team, and went around to 10 or 12 of these schools, and we found out that no one really knew how to read, no one, and no one knew how to count. They could count if they had their two fingers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, but if you said, what's 6 + 6, forget it. They could not get that far. So I said, we're going to close down this program now. And the contractor at the time said, no, we're not. We were only contracted to a number of, our indicator was how many kids were in the classroom. And I said, you know what? Do you really want me to go on national radio? Do you really want me to go to the Congress? Do you really want me to start talking about how $50 million of the U.S. taxpayers' money is being spent in Liberia? They decided to play along with what I wanted. And what we did there was we started tying literacy to skills. So if you wanted to be, in order to rebuild Liberia, if you wanted to be a mechanic or a plumber or a hairdresser or whatever, then we would teach you language skills around that skill area. So that meant something to you. You weren't just sitting in a classroom. And also it meant that you could have a job, which was, very, very, very important for the rebuilding. So you have to be creative. You can't say no. And you have to be always one step ahead of failure, which in the third world is very easy to come by. And you can't get discouraged either. It's so easy to say, we'd spent 2 years building this thing up, and now what? Well, how can we make it better? How can we make it more sustainable? How can we get people more involved, especially politicians? And corruption in the third world is you know, a huge problem. And so how do you work around that so that you can make sure that the people that you're working for and with really benefit from what you're doing? And, you know, it's possible.
I have one last question for you, and this is around your final post, which was as the U.S. ambassador to Haiti. You were brought in not long after a fairly devastating earthquake that took place. How did you manage to right the ship, even just a little bit?
Yeah, this is actually, thank you for that question, because I love this question. I first was brought in from, I was mission director to Liberia when the quake actually happened, and they brought me right away into Washington to run the Haiti task force, because I knew Haiti. And so I saw all the devastation. I saw it was unbelievable. 250,000 people were dead in 5 minutes. It's so inconceivable that when I tell the story, people will look at me like with a blank face, because think of that number. You can't. 250,000 people dead, 1.2 million people without homes, 1 million people with some horrific injury, no running water, no airport, no port. I mean, the place was devastated. I mean, it just diminished. And what the United States did, the United States of America, and I mean that in total, the NGOs, the military especially, all these little groups of people coming, the United States government. I mean, it was a miracle, truly a miracle what we did 2 years after that quake, because Haiti was she wasn't on her knees, she was flattened down. And we took 1.2 million people and we found them temporary housing. We took 1 million people and we found them some ways of treatment. We took 1 million people at least and found food for them. We took the airport and we rebuilt it. We took when we started after the quake, the U.S. military was down there with a makeshift airport, which was really a huge ladder or two with somebody standing up there just to get emergency planes in there. It was unbelievable. And if you go there now, it's a modern, lovely airport. And so when people are like, well, why didn't you turn Haiti into Switzerland or some sort of remodel? There's so many poor people still in Haiti. I think you have to look back to that day in 2010 when the earthquake happened, that devastating day, and then say, well, what did we do to rebuild Haiti and get Haiti not just on her knees from flat out, but, you know, halfway up? And they are, I think, better, tremendously better off than they were the day of that earthquake. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And it cost $1 billion to get Haiti up off that, you know, down position. And the Haitians, God love the Haitians, because they were so resilient. They're the ones that got up. I mean, we didn't get up. We helped them get up. And they're very, very proud of the effort that they put into remaking their country again, which, you know, is so tremendous. How do you get over 250,000 people dying in 5 minutes? And yet they did, and they are. And they're just these people that I admire so much for doing that. And you can see the hope in the eyes of the young people. So when you walk into a school and say, you know, let's rebuild your country, and they're, yeah, you know, we want to do that, and there's this enthusiasm and this light, then it just makes your world a better place. And so that, I think, is the gift of Haiti, teaching us how to go on. And they did.
Pam, it's really been a pleasure to have this conversation with you. I appreciate the work that you've done really all over the world. I love the fact that you are from, well, born in Lewiston, raised in Auburn, went to Edward Little, went to the University of Maine.
I did.
I have many family members who have gone, including my son, who watched your commencement speech. And I appreciate the work also that your husband, Steve, did as part of the Foreign Service. I think this type of work is maybe something that we here who live in Maine most of our lives don't know that much about. But I know that it's important, and I think it's great that we have someone from our state who was out there really on the ground doing this. And I appreciate your being here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I loved every minute of it. Congratulations. Great studio here. And keep on the great work.
Thank you.